funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. It appears the Republican Party has its presidential nominee for 2016.
And so, with a heavy heart, but with boundless optimism for the long-term future of our nation, we are suspending our campaign.
And as I suspend my campaign today, I have renewed faith, deeper faith, that the Lord will show me the way forward and fulfill the purpose of my life.
Suspending those campaigns, of course, you heard Senator Ted Cruz and Ohio Governor John Kasich. Since entering the race last year, Donald J. Trump has made a mockery of anyone who dismissed him as some kind of novelty candidate, remaining the last man standing in a field that once included a number of contenders with considerable political experience and close ties to party leaders. Establishment Republicans have been divided over Trump. The former presidents Bush have declined to endorse him as their party's nominee, and 2012 Republican candidate Mitt Romney warns Trump's economic ambitions would plunge the country into a prolonged recession. On the other hand, prominent Republicans, including New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and former Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, say they will support Mr. Trump as nominee. Meanwhile, on the other side of the political spectrum, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is vowing to remain in the race despite the daunting lead held by former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. All in all, a very unusual political season. Joining us to talk about what all this means, we have two guests. Harold Clark is professor of political science at UTD. Jeffrey Engel is director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU. Gentlemen, welcome to Think.
Hi, good to see you.
Good to see you.
What does candidate Trump say about the state and makeup of the Republican Party in 2016?
I think that the success of Trump's candidacy reflects primarily the deep anger that a lot of voters who have been GOP supporters in the past and some who have not been GOP supporters feel about the way that the country is going and what its prospects are and their own personal prospects as well. If things keep going the way they are. And Trump's success, and Sanders as well, reflects this deep disaffection with the political and economic establishment in this country.
That was Harold Clark. Jeffrey Engel, why this anger now? I mean, you know, certainly in almost every season, there is something for voters to be dismayed about with their parties.
We're just seeing remarkable levels of discontent within the country. We're seeing remarkable income inequality in particular, and income inequality which is reaching further and further into different parts of the country that never experienced it before. But at the same time, I think we're also seeing a great deal of cultural discontent, in particular from the right, in particular from the Republican Party, in particular from people who find themselves animated by what Trump is saying, an idea that the country doesn't appear to look the way it used to, the way that they felt comfortable with it looking. I mean, one of the things that's completely astounding is the percentage of non-white voters that we're going to see in this electorate is going to be higher than we've ever seen before. Over 30% of the electorate this year is going to be a non-white voter. 95% of the electorate within the Republican Party are white voters. So we're seeing Donald Trump essentially speaking to voters who are economically uncomfortable and culturally uncomfortable with the way the country is going and animating a large percentage of the Republican base to the polls, in large part because of a discontent over where they see the country going.
George H.W. Bush has endorsed every Republican nominee since he left office in 1993. His decision not to come out in support of Mr. Trump was couched in terms of his retirement from politics. Clearly, this is a polite way of making a very clear statement.
I think so. And we have to remember as well that his son was a candidate and a year ago, really the odds-on favorite, I think, amongst most serious political commentators to be the Republican nominee this year. And, of course, Jeb Bush's candidacy failed really quite miserably. And to be sure, this has got to be a factor as well.
I think the personal matters, but also we have to remember that the Republican Party itself has been moving radically from where George H.W. Bush resided when he was president. I mean, we have to remember Bush, in fact, was conservative enough to become president of the United States, but was never conservative enough to win statewide office in Texas. He tried and failed several times. Mm-hmm. And I think it's we could really say that George H.W. Bush today really has no ideological place in today's Republican Party, either because of Donald Trump's nativism, which Bush would not have been in favor of, and frankly also because that there, we could argue that Trump is not really a free trade, pro-capitalist conservative that George H.W. Bush was either. There's really very little place that Bush would feel comfortable, they're talking about the senior Bush, in today's Republican Party, and I think that Trump's nomination only puts an exclamation point on the discomfort.
Mitt Romney made a speech about Bush in March. Let's listen to just a little bit of it here.
Think of Donald Trump's personal qualities, the bullying, the greed, the showing off, the misogyny, the absurd third grade theatrics. You know, we've long referred to him as the Donald. He's the only person in the entire country to whom we have added an article before his name. And it wasn't because he had attributes we admired.
That was Mitt Romney speaking there about Donald Trump. Governor Romney has also said he will not attend the convention. Is this unprecedented?
I'm not sure if it's unprecedented, but it's certainly a sign of the deep split between the Republican establishment, new and old, and the insurgency that's represented by Donald Trump, but also, of course, to some extent by his main opponent, Ted Cruz. After all, Mr. Cruz prided himself as being an outsider, a rebel against the Republican establishment in Washington. Certainly Romney's absence, though, is a very good and strong sign of just how deep this split is. And it remains to be seen, of course, what the consequences will be in November.
Well, and previous presidents and presidential nominees for a party are generally embraced by their successors, even if not within the rest of the party. I mean, think back about Richard Nixon, a person who clearly did not leave office in great favor with the electorate. He was never really invited back to the convention, but was still sought after by subsequent presidents, Democrat and Republican alike, for his advice, for his expertise, for his guidance. Similarly with George W. Bush, who, of course, in 2008 was remarkably unpopular with the electorate, a popularity rating in the summer of about 19-20% in 2008. He was a person who was not really welcome at the convention, but he was still sought after by political elites and by party elites. It's a very rare thing that we're seeing right now to have a party's nominee turn his back on previous nominees and vice versa. Usually the people at the top, not just because they consider themselves part of the establishment, but because these are people who know what each other have gone through. They've been in the ring together. They understand and speak the same language. It's very unusual to see a candidate completely turn his back on his previous nominees.
Of course, in the past, all of the people who would take those spots were part of the establishment. And it's very different with Donald Trump. I'm curious, though, if you both think that the current wave of anti-Trump rhetoric from certain party loyalists will have to soften over the next few months.
I think it will to some extent for a combination of collective and individual reasons. There will be some people who will believe it's in their interest to get on board with Mr. Trump and to work with him, regardless of whether he's successful or not. There'll be others who are motivated by collective concerns. They are party supporters. They are deep Republican loyalists. And when they see the alternative, when it really the full appreciation comes that it's going to be either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, who many of them really dislike and have disliked for decades, then they will come on board. They may be reluctant, but they will come on board. There will be others who will not. But my guess right now is that you will see a goodly number of them at least publicly say that they are going to be Republican voters and Republican supporters in November.
You know, I have to say I have a somewhat different perspective on that. I think that we are going to see, as you said, a lot of people come out and publicly support Trump as a nominee. But I think a lot of the support is going to be only an inch deep. I think we're not going to see a lot of enthusiasm within the Republican Party for a Trump support – for a Trump candidacy. And I think in large reason it's because that they're going to be secretly hoping that Trump fails, that Hillary is a candidate who they're not necessarily going to embrace, obviously, for ideological and for long-term political reasons. But she's also not a person who frightens them as much as Trump does. I mean, Hillary Clinton, for whatever we say about her, is a known quantity, whereas Trump, for all the divisions that he's demonstrated within the Republican Party, if he loses and if he loses badly – then there's a real good sense that the standard establishment Republicans, the Paul Ryans of the world, will essentially be able to re-solidify their control over the party. They'll essentially be able to turn to their party fellow delegates and fellow members of the party and say, we tried the radical approach. We tried the unusual approach. And no pun intended, we got trumped. So consequently, let's come back and support ourselves the way we always knew we were. Let's get back to being genuine conservatives, if you will, and that essentially a Trump demise, a Trump debacle, is in a sense the best thing for the establishment if they want to retain control of their own party.
Months ago, a lot of loyal Democrats were hoping that the Republican nominee would be Donald Trump, thinking that he would be the easiest person in the world to beat. I'm not sure that swagger is still present.
I think that they're very nervous. They're nervous only because they, you know, every prediction that we've ever had about Donald Trump in politics has thus far proven wrong. So anyone who tells you they're confident in what we can expect to see from a Trump general candidacy is either trying to sell you something or is deluding themselves. And they just simply don't know. We don't know what Trump is going to do. We don't know what he's going to act. He keeps saying that he's going to act presidential, and that usually lasts about 24 hours before he says something else that's unusual and bombastic, and most importantly, that captures the headlines. And so Trump's ability to really maintain not only the media's attention and the public's general attention, but also to maintain the narrative in a discussion arena that he is most comfortable in is really unprecedented and astounding. And I think that people who are supporting Hillary Clinton have to worry themselves not so much that Trump is going to say things about their candidate that haven't been said before, because frankly, there's very few things about Hillary Clinton negative that haven't been said among her critics over the past 25, 30 years, but rather that he's going to say it in a way that's going to keep the attention on him and not on her and not on the policies that she wants to put forward.
Harold, Donald Trump is very wealthy, but maybe not wealthy enough to self-fund a general election campaign. He is taking donations on his website, but in relatively small amounts. He's made it very clear that he has great disdain for the kind of people who might drop $1 million or two into his campaign war chest. What will he do about fundraising moving forward?
I think that's a very good question. He undoubtedly will need to raise funds. He cannot be self-funding in the general election, given the huge amount of money that the Democrats have assembled. We're talking, well over $1 billion, maybe more. So he really has no choice. Whether he'll be able to do it, given what we've just been saying about his anti-establishment attitudes and the enmity that he's created amongst the kinds of people who have the funds to provide to him, should they choose to do so, remains to be seen. But I think he definitely is going to have to reach out to some of those people and use his friends. And he does have friends, of course, in the establishment. It's a mistake to think that he does not. And we'll just see how it goes. But he has no choice.
But I think he's also going to have to he's going to have to reach out. That's obviously true. And he's going to need more money than he can self-generate. That's obviously true. But I think we need to recognize that he may have actually hit upon a new model of politicking that we've not seen before, which is incredibly cheap. Not only has he managed to get untold billions of dollars worth of free advertising that other candidates within the Republican field would have loved to have gotten just by simply the bravado and the bombast of his rhetoric. Frankly, it doesn't cost him anything to tweet. And when he tweets, that's free. When we talk about his tweets, that's free. It's really a remarkable opportunity he has to remake the economics of politicking.
Jeffrey Engel is director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU. Harold Clark is professor of political science at UTD. We will continue our conversation about this political season in just 2 minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can tweet us. It's free. My handle is at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
We're going after Hillary Clinton. She will not... She will not be a great president. She will not be a good president. She will be a poor president. She doesn't understand trade. Her husband signed, perhaps in the history of the world, the single worst trade deal ever done. It's called NAFTA. And I was witness to the carnage.
I've seen the presidency up close from two different perspectives, and I think I know what it takes. And I don't think we can take a risk on a loose cannon like Donald Trump running our country. You know, Donald Trump has said it's okay for other countries to get nuclear weapons. I think that's just downright dangerous. He has said wages are too high. I think we need to have a raise for the American people, raise the minimum wage, get wages back going up. I think when he says women should be punished for having abortions, that is, you know, just beyond anything that I can imagine. I think most women can imagine.
He did walk that back.
Well, he's a loose cannon.
That was Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton talking about one another. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Harold Clark, who is professor of political science at UTD, and Jeffrey Engel, director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU. At this point, it definitely seems as if Secretary Clinton is focusing her attention on defeating Donald Trump as opposed to paying much attention to what is happening in the Sanders campaign, which continues to plug along. What keeps Bernie Sanders in this race despite the really intimidating lead that Secretary Clinton has for the Democratic nomination?
I think that there are a couple of factors. First of all, Bernie Sanders is a movement candidate. He's an ideologically based and ideologically motivated candidate, and he genuinely and sincerely believes in what he is doing and the cause that he has, and many of his supporters do as well. The second thing is that he has enjoyed considerable success, and if it wasn't for the so-called superdelegates, this would be a really close race. I think what he's hoping to do ultimately will be to go to that national convention and have an influence on the policy platform that the Democrats take forward into the November election.
I think there's one additional element, which is actually, I think, the simplest but maybe the most important, that he has nothing else to go back to. Ted Cruz is still hoping to be the nominee of the Republican Party in 2020 or 2024 or 2028, and he's hoping that he can maintain good relations with different parts of the party. Same thing with John Kasich, who I think is probably hoping at this point that he's at perhaps on Trump's short list for vice president. Nobody thinks that Bernie Sanders is going to be vice presidential material. He's in his mid-70s. He's not going to be running again. This is his moment in the spotlight, and there's really no reason to give it up because he can then become just one of 100 senators again, which he already was.
When I started this campaign, it was an extraordinarily uphill battle. We were 60 points behind Secretary Clinton. Polls out there now, in the last few weeks, if you had us actually ahead in national polls or a few points behind. The path to victory is to do extremely well in the remaining states. And as you indicate, California, of course, is the largest state. And we hope to do very well there and win that state.
In terms of making calculations about trying to bring new voters on board, will Secretary Clinton be able to count on the people who really love Bernie Sanders to vote for her? And therefore, does she need to focus on some of these never Trump folks, who some of whom, including some very prominent Republicans, have reluctantly said, I will cast a ballot for Hillary Clinton before Donald Trump?
I think that her best approach at this point is simply going to remind people who her opponent is going to be. That if we break down the electorate and we look at the exit polls for the last couple of primaries, we see that a remarkable amount of people dislike both Clinton and Trump. In fact,
let me interrupt. 56% dislike Donald Trump, 49% dislike Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, we've never seen dislikes this high for candidates of this stage on both parties. But what's interesting, if you peel back the numbers a little bit, the reason they dislike him is actually somewhat different. People dislike Secretary Clinton because they don't seem to like her personally, and they distrust her personally, and they don't find that she is necessarily always truthful personally. But they don't question her competence. People who dislike Trump seem to use the word fear more, that they are afraid of what he would be like as president. They're afraid of what he might do. They're afraid of his unpredictability because, frankly, he's still an unknown quantity. So I think that the more that Hillary Clinton can talk up Donald Trump as her opponent, not necessarily the Republicans, not necessarily his ideas, but simply him as a person, the more it's going to drive people who are supporting Sanders or people who are from the Never Trump movement, obviously, to say, well, we might not necessarily like Clinton. We might have preferred someone else, but we certainly don't want Trump, so we'll cast our vote for his opponent.
Harold Clark, we haven't seen a great deal of evidence that Donald Trump is putting on an act for the primary contest, or has been, and will sort of display more gravitas moving forward. But there are a lot of people who support Trump that feel pretty confident that this is all just bluster and bravado and that we can trust this guy. What do you think it is about him that inspires that kind of confidence among people who maybe haven't seen evidence of this but still believe that when push comes to shove, he will be a competent leader?
I think in part he can rely on the claims that he makes and are largely, not wholly, but largely not gainsaid, that he is a successful person, a highly successful person, a billionaire. He builds things. He hires people. He knows the art of the deal. He makes this claim, and he's got a lot of prima facie evidence historically that, yeah, he's the guy who's actually done something in life other than sit around in Washington and be part of the political elite. And I think that's really what gives him his credibility, and it allows him to do things that most politicians don't. And when he comes out and he says things that seem outrageous or really out of the mainstream, and they are, these actually are taken as evidence of his willingness to really get things done. He says, hey, it's time. Let's do something real. Let's get people back to work. I'm the guy who can do this. These other guys, whether they're on the left, if they're in the Democratic Party, or on the right in the Republican Party, are basically all hoodwinking you. And they're a lot of hot air. And I think that, you know, this combination of perceived success along with a perception that he says it like it is really is his strong suit. And I don't think he's going to go too far away from it. You may disagree, but I don't think he's going to go too far away from this during the general election campaign.
No, I think the remarkable thing about Donald Trump at the end of the day is how little he actually says, and therefore how much people can read into what he says. If we look back to his first real attempt at a substantial address, he addressed foreign policy a couple weeks ago and said remarkably obvious statements that were remarkably contradictory. For example, he said we need to stand up and show good support for our allies and be trustworthy for our allies. And then in the next paragraph, he said, but of course, we need to be unpredictable. And people listening to this will say, well, yes, actually, on the one hand, we should be unpredictable. We should actually make the world a little bit, you know, uncomfortable with what we're doing. But at the same time, we, of course, do need to be good allies. And people can hear this and say, you know, this all sounds obvious. It all sounds correct. And if he's not pushed on any details, he's never has to provide any details. If he has no details to offer, people will be able to read into it whatever details they want and just presume that, yes, jobs will come back. Yes, presume that we'll be able to cut better deals without actually explaining how. I think a remarkable example is his ongoing railing against the Iranian nuclear deal that the Obama administration helped sign with the other P5 nations plus Germany to regulate and to try to keep the Iranians from developing their own nuclear weapon. He has called that the worst deal in history. He has not yet said why. He has not yet given a reason for why this is the worst deal in history, except that, well, you can't trust Obama and you can't trust the Iranians. There's this 150-page detailed deal that requires a lot of specifics and a lot of regulations that a lot of different countries have signed on to. There's plenty of reasons to critique this deal. He has not yet offered one, save to say it's a terrible deal. And as long as you're willing to suspend any investigatory analysis on your own right to ask what he's actually saying, you can really become very enamored by the claims that he's making.
Mr. Trump has this really notable populist appeal, and it's been fascinating to me because we have seen the silver spoon effect really damage the prospects of other candidates in the past. I think about John Kerry and Mitt Romney, most notably. Why does this not stick to Donald Trump?
I think it's the interaction that I mentioned between his wealth and his success in perceived success in generating wealth on the one hand and his personality on the other. And I think this produces a very different effect in the mind of the voter than a consistent sort of, if you will, a sort of gentlemanly style that candidates certainly like Mitt Romney had, along with their claims and rightly, you know, well-deserved claims for being very successful in the business world. I think it's this interaction, though, that produces a very different effect. One other thing I would say as well has to do with setting out goals and making claims of competence as opposed to offering detailed sorts of policy plans. No less than Barack Obama, of course, 8 years ago, played what we call the valence politics game probably more successfully than any candidate in recent memory. Slogans like hope and change, you can, you know, we will do it, you can trust me, of course, are really very important ways for politicians to move ahead, politically and with the electorate. Offering specific policies, we find in our research, really doesn't appeal to average people. They don't understand it. What they want is to be able to trust this idea, the image of this combination of competence and responsiveness to the ordinary person is incredibly powerful for building trust. And so far, Donald Trump has hit on this in a very sort of odd and unique way compared to many other candidates, including Mr. Obama, but he's doing it. And it's a very powerful strategy in politics.
So you and I might hope for different kinds of change, but if the details are left a little amorphous, we can just fill in the blanks.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Mark on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Mark.
Hey. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just curious about your panel's response to the idea that, you know, what you have on both sides of the aisle are these populist sort of anti-establishment movements, Trump being on the Republican side, Sanders on the other. And as far as Donald Trump, I'm sort of amused at the media's fixation on him more so than the message behind him, at least as it comes from the voters. You know, I sort of feel like they're saying they want to fire their government, and they've sent the guy who sort of made "you're fired" into his tagline. And same thing with Sanders. But I was just curious about your panelists' response to that idea.
Thanks for your call.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think it's actually very dangerous because there really is a sense that a vote for Trump is a vote of protest against Washington and a vote of protest against politics as usual and a vote of protest against the system. I mean, how many times have we even heard Trump rail against the Republican system of electing candidates, of selecting candidates, that basically if you are voting for Trump, it's because you are angry and want to throw the bums out. The problem is somebody does have to sit in the Oval Office. I mean, to use Hillary Clinton's catchphrase from more than 8 years ago, that somebody actually has to answer the phone at 3 a.m. when it rings with a crisis. And I'm concerned that the votes which are being cast for Trump as a protest are not necessarily Trump votes that are being cast for Trump as president, though that, of course, is the net effect, that voters are essentially going to be surprised when they suddenly have this choice to be made between a person who has been in office for many, many years and represents politics as usual, that being Hillary Clinton, and a person who, frankly, has no experience and no guidance to go on within government whatsoever. And that's really a choice that people are going to be surprised, I think, that they have to make at this point because so many of them were angry enough to vote for a person who, frankly, has no experience whatsoever.
How many of the people who have voted throughout the primary season, and we should say there are a number of other states yet to vote, how many of them will come back in November and cast another ballot?
I think that turnout is that's a very, you know, a very good question for political analysts and of course, for the politicians themselves. Turnout is always very important in elections, and I think it's going to be especially important in this election, perhaps for the Democrats more than the Republicans in the sense that Barack Obama was very successful in stimulating turnout amongst core support groups, the African-American community, Hispanics, the gay and lesbian communities, and so forth. That base, the so-called Democratic base, came out not just once but twice in abnormally large numbers compared to historical data for Barack Obama. Whether Hillary can do this or not remains to be seen. And I think it's going to be very important for her. I had the sense on the other side that Trump, because of his emotional appeals, will turn out a lot of people. We've talked earlier this morning about some of the difficulties he may have with the establishment. And, of course, that may be the trade-off in the end.
I think this is the real reason why there are people within the Democratic camp who are enthusiastic, given the last few choices that they had on the Republican side, enthusiastic that Trump would win. Because on the one hand, while I mentioned before, Trump is a wild card and Trump is a joker, and we don't quite know exactly what Trump is going to say. We never know what's going to come out of his mouth next. On the other hand, we do know that Trump has said enough things to rile up traditional Democratic supporters, to rile up the Hispanic community, which has always been wavering between Republican and Democrat for the last generation, and certainly to rile up the Democratic base of African Americans. And so if we're thinking about how Hillary Clinton can get people to the polls, which of course is going to be key for her success, certainly Donald Trump is a person who does it half the way for her, that he actually gets people animated enough to get to the polls themselves in some ways. So on the one hand, whereas we see Trump, who is somebody who is unpredictable, on the other hand, he does bring some bonuses, if you will, if you're a Democratic strategist.
Will Trump's nomination drive Latinos out of the Republican Party that the party has worked very hard to cultivate over the past several years?
I think so. But going back to something I mentioned earlier, I think that there is an element within the Republican establishment who, back in the last election, were discussing this as well, basically demonstrating that if we continue to be the party of nativism and the party of conservative whites, essentially, that we're not going to be able to capture the 21st century, looking at the Hispanic community in particular as a target group that in many ways should be voting Republican, that given the emphasis of immigration reform and given the emphasis, frankly, of the truly bombastic things that Trump has said about that community in general, that there's an element in which establishment Republicans are essentially going to hope that they can turn back the tide, if you will, of Trump's anti-Latino rhetoric by simply saying, if he loses bad enough, well, that will demonstrate that we're not really the party of Trump.
Jeffrey Engel is director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU. We're speaking also this hour with Harold Clark, professor of political science at UTD. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour about partisan politics in the primary season with Harold Clark, who is professor of political science at UTD, and Jeffrey Engel, director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Jeffrey Engel, how much do Americans care whether the people running for president have a lot of relevant experience in government?
Well, I think in this election, clearly having relevant experience in government has been a detriment, certainly for John Kasich. I mean, it's hard to imagine a person with a better legislative resume and executive experience as governor of a major swing state than Kasich. And obviously, he was barely able to get any traction at all. And this has been part of Trump's appeal, of course, is that he has real-world experience. He has hired people. He has fired people, obviously. That's his tagline. But it's important to recognize that experience in government is actually a different beast than experience in the business world or in other areas. The last person that was a major party nominee to come into the campaign at this stage without any government experience as an elected official was Dwight Eisenhower. Now,
Who still understood bureaucracy.
Well, I was going to say, Dwight Eisenhower had a pretty good resume. I mean, you beat Hitler. That goes a long way on your CV. And I'm always reminded of something that Harry Truman said after Eisenhower was elected, but before he was inaugurated. Harry Truman, of course, was the president, and he said essentially, actually pity poor Ike. You got to feel bad for poor Ike because he's a general and he's used to people doing what he says, much like a businessman, you might think. He's used to ordering people to do things and having it get done. He's going to come into office and say, do this, do that, do this. And amazingly, nothing's going to happen. Because that's not the way government works. Government is about persuading people, especially in our divided form of government. Government is about compromise, government about negotiation away from principle. It's not about giving orders. And I think that this is something that a business person with Trump's experiences, I think, and a general too, as with Eisenhower, is at the very least going to take some time to learn.
I think that's a wonderful quote, of course, from Harry Truman, very famous commentary on the relevance of business, non-governmental experience, if you will, for actually being effective as a chief executive in government. And, of course, this is one of the real downsides, if you will, for a candidacy by someone such as Donald Trump. In terms of getting there, on the other hand, that's another story. And as I said before, the key equation for a candidate for major office, maybe minor office as well, is competence plus perceived responsiveness equals trust. And trying to establish that in the voter's mind is what every candidate has to do, and they try to do it in different ways. We've seen Mr. Trump's highly unorthodox way of proceeding, and I think we will have an extremely good contrast with Hillary Clinton, who will have a much more orthodox way of going about establishing this equation in the voters' minds in November.
I think that's exactly right. I think it's fascinating, especially to see the comparison between not only Trump and Clinton, but Sanders and Clinton in this regard, that Sanders and Trump are both making really remarkable promises to which Hillary Clinton's response throughout her primary with Sanders has essentially been, that's a wonderful idea. How do you get it done? How are you actually going to do it? And that's been her experience in government,
exactly,
is getting things done. Now, I do have to go back and point out that if you are a protest voter that we were describing before, everything which I just said and everything which you just said, you're nodding your head and saying, that's exactly why we need to get rid of these people, because that they only think about process and they don't think about getting things done. And that's why we need somebody from the outside. So, you know, government experience, as you point out, is definitely a detriment to the electorate. It's usually pretty useful when you're actually in government.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Natalie on the line in Wichita Falls. Hi, Natalie.
Hello, Chris. How are you? I'm enjoying your show.
Thanks.
Okay. Questions to a guest, please, here, or at least my comments. I noticed the language that Donald Trump has used just recently referring to the presidential quality of Hillary Clinton. I picked up on this because I'm very much into the language. He keeps using will. She will not be a great president. She will not be a good president. She will be a poor president. He does not say or use the word would.
That's a really interesting thing to notice.
That is interesting. You know, I picked up on that, but in a different way. So I'm fascinated. I'd love to hear more of your caller's thoughts on this, I guess, because I did not think of it. I was surprised that he used the term will be a bad president, because that presupposes that she had already won the election. The language is a very unusual construction, that when he says that she will be a terrible president. Well, hopefully not if he has any say about it. So I think what he really would have been better off saying, this is picking apart language from a person who's speaking off the cuff, is that she will never be president. She will never be president because of the following qualities. It's a very unusual construction. But then again, Donald Trump has a lot of unusual constructions.
I think so. And I think you have to think about the audience. Who is he talking to? And the use of what we might think of as not the appropriate construction, the appropriate verb or what have you, may be quite acceptable when you're speaking to disaffected working class people out in Indiana or wherever you may be targeting your message. So I wouldn't read too much into that. It's a very interesting construction, something that we might think about, but I don't think it really would have much effect. In fact, it may work in a positive way for the audience that he's trying to reach.
Yeah, just to reinforce on this point, you know, scholars and journalists do a lot of work analyzing essentially the language that different politicians use and try essentially put a grade level on it. It's remarkable that Donald Trump speaks throughout this campaign at essentially a third grade level. Hillary Clinton's about a sixth grade level. Bernie Sanders is about a fifth grade level. It's very rare for a politician to ever make it into junior high, but Donald Trump certainly is lower than the norm.
Is Mr. – you know, there are people, observers who say that Donald Trump wants to win the presidency more than he wants to do the presidency, more than he wants to be president. Is there any truth to that, or is that simply a snipe?
I think that there may be something to that. After all, traveling around in the Air Force One will probably be a step down from the Trump jet that he regularly parks in Palm Beach. But, you know, I think there is more, you know, more seriously, there probably is something to this. After all, being president is a 24/7 job, and it's a tough job. And as we've said, it's not one where you can simply get your way by saying you're fired or you will be fired if you don't do X. Doing X may be a very difficult and even intractable thing to accomplish. And so, you know, this may well be the case. I'm not sure that Mr. Trump himself has fully thought this through, but it's a very real concern, perhaps especially for someone. I mean, he's close to 70 years old and will be in his mid-70s by the end of his first term, should he be elected. And so at that stage in life, you know, this is a very important consideration.
Yeah, you know, one of the really interesting things about Trump is that and this is something that his supporters and critics say alike, is that he doesn't hide anything. And one of the things that's important to remember about the presidency is that it requires a remarkable sense of hubris and self-confidence to think that you, more than anyone else among the 300 odd million people in the country, are qualified to handle the country's problems. In fact, we can go a step further and say that since we're the most powerful country in the world, you, more than anyone else among the 8 billion people in the world, is qualified to be in charge of nuclear weapons and the trade of a nation and the culture of a nation and life and death decisions. Every candidate who runs for president has to have this hubris. Trump seems to be the only one who openly talks about it, that is really comfortable with his hubris. And it makes us uncomfortable because one of the little hidden secrets that we like to have our presidents, who, of course, are required to show an unbelievable sense of almost narcissism in order to believe that they are that qualified more than anyone else around them. We want them to at least hide it. Trump has no pretense.
Is there a dark horse third party candidate out there somewhere? Is there a possibility of like a Ross Perot showing in 2016?
I don't see it at this point. I think that you could have had it been a contested convention at the Republican side, I think there was a possibility for that. I think there was a big movement for Paul Ryan, of course, several weeks ago until he put the kibosh on that, which again, my interpretation of that is that Ryan is a person who's looking at his long-term future and recognizing that if Trump loses and loses badly as a radical within the party is going to come back to its center base. And who else is in the center besides the Speaker of the House? So I think that those who might have come from a Republican establishment position at this point have given up trying to get the Republican nomination. And there's really no one out there that I see on the horizon who's going to run a credible third party candidacy.
I think the way that I agree, and I think the way that this would have played out with a contested convention would have been if, in fact, the Republican establishment had coalesced and denied the nomination to Mr. Trump, and it would have been Trump himself who would have been the third party candidate. Now that that option is off the table, I agree that that's not going to happen. There's not going to be a third party candidacy of any note at all. There's always, of course, situations where you get very, very minor candidates. Maybe a Green candidate or something like this will be running, or the New Marxist Coalition or something like this, which will get a few hundred votes. But no, the serious third party candidacy option, I believe you're absolutely right, is off the table now.
Well, and this is really the fatal flaw of the Cruz campaign, you know, doing a quick snap history of the Cruz campaign. The idea that he was hoping to coalesce as the anti-Trump candidate by the end, he almost forgot for a moment that he was not actually a popular person within the party himself. And so, you know, when we think back about the fact that the campaign essentially came down to Trump versus Cruz, one could argue if it had been Trump versus somebody more from the center, somebody who was more popular, somebody who had more support throughout the party, that that might have been a better fit for a non-Trump candidacy. But the fact that there was nobody within the party who could stand up and essentially defeat Trump one-on-one merely demonstrates, I think, that Cruz was not going to do it and that there was nobody else who can come up and really knock him off. I mean, one good way to think about this Republican primary, since there were 17 candidates at the beginning, it's a little bit like the NCAA basketball tournament. You know, you only have to knock off the person who you're facing and the rest of them will fall apart in different competitions. It's unlikely that we could say at this point that Trump and necessarily the best candidate. He's merely the last one standing.
What do down ballot races look like for Republicans in contested places with Mr. Trump at the top of the ticket?
I think that there's a great deal of worry amongst Republican incumbents that the Trump candidacy will be a debacle and that they will be collateral damage in what would really be a sweep by the Democrats led by Hillary Clinton. And in this regard, always, of course, when you're looking at down-ballot races, particularly for the Senate, you have to take a look at any particular election cycle, who's up and who's not up and what kind of state are they representing. And this time around, unlike 2014, there are a number of Republicans who will be running who are in states where it's quite competitive normally. And if, in fact, there was a landslide for the Democrats, they may well find themselves out of office. And this is certainly a worry for those people right now. And I'm sure they're sitting around worrying about exactly this point.
Well, and John McCain of Arizona just made this exact point candidly. I don't think he realized he was making it publicly, that this is, he said, going to be the most difficult election of his entire career because obviously the Trump brings in an anti-Hispanic element, which, of course, is crucial in his state of Arizona.
Indeed.
And so when we think about a not only an establishment candidate, a person who used to be referred to as a maverick, but, of course, is now well within the establishment, a nominee of a major political party worried about losing his Senate seat because of a subsequent nominee, it's really an astounding thing.
Has Ted Cruz already booked his Airbnb for Dubuque 2020?
I think he'd probably be wise to buy a house at this point because he's going to be there. If he's not there in 2020, he'll be back in 2024. Clearly, if there's one thing that we've seen from Ted Cruz is that he is interested in the future of Ted Cruz and that his political ambition only has one goal at this point, which is to be president of the United States. And I think we have not seen the last of him on the primary trail.
I agree, and I think we certainly have not seen the last of Paul Ryan either. We mentioned him before. I think he really represents in many ways the future of the Republican Party going forward, regardless of what happens this fall. He's from a new generation.
You know, and I think there's one other important point to make here as we start thinking about 2020, that Barack Obama is actually a relatively popular president at this time in his election cycle and at the end of his 8 years. He's at about 51-52%. Ronald Reagan in 1988 was about 51-52%. In both instances, the economy was doing relatively well. There were discontents of a potential recession on the horizon. But overwhelmingly, the policies of the president were supported by the people. And Hillary Clinton is running essentially to be Barack Obama's third term. And this is something I think that has a lot of popularity within the party and a lot of popularity within the electorate in general. But it's very unusual for a party to win four elections in a row. So my money at this point would be to put your money on the Democrats in 2016, but on whoever the Republican candidate is in 2020.
Jeffrey Engel is director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU. Harold Clark is professor of political science at UTD. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank
Pleasure.
You.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our associate producer is Samantha Guzman, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.